Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman, a senior lecturer at the American University School of International Service and a genocide studies scholar. Thank you all for listening. Today, I'll be talking to John Roth about The Failure of Ethics, Confronting the Holocaust, Genocide, and Other Mass Atrocities, published in paperback by Oxford University Press in 2018. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm really honored to be with you today.
And I'm honored to have you. And you are, I think, in some ways, a certified regular on the New Books Network, this being, by my count, your fifth appearance. For our listeners who might be less familiar with you and your work, can you tell our audience a bit about yourself and what led you to write The Failure of Ethics?
Sure. I'm presently an emeritus professor of philosophy from Claremont McKenna College in California, where I taught for more than 40 years. I've been working on the Holocaust and genocide-related issues for about 50 years, as it turns out. I live presently in rural Washington State in a little town called Winthrop, which is a beautiful spot. And in my retirement, I have had a great place to continue my research projects and my writing. I look upon my retirement as an extended sabbatical, and I've continued to focus on issues that have to do with mass atrocity crimes, genocide, and the Holocaust in particular. I've done a book more recently than The Failures of Ethics, actually, which I call Sources of Holocaust Insight. It's a kind of retrospective that looks back on the various people who have especially influenced my thinking about the Holocaust and genocide. And I imagine some of those names may come up as we carry on our conversation today, Jeff.
Thanks, John. Great. So let's get into the book and we'll see where this goes. Opening up your book, you write, quote, "Although these catastrophes do not pronounce the death of ethics, they show that ethics is vulnerable, subject to misuse and perversion, and that no simple reaffirmation of ethics, as if nothing disastrous has happened or had happened, will do." Can you talk about a few things here for our listeners? First, perhaps a question with an obvious answer, but what do ethics have to do with genocide and other mass atrocities?
Sure. Let me back up just a little bit. My idea for writing about the failures of ethics, which has to do actually with your question very directly, was inspired by my reading of the poet William Stafford. He's an American poet, no longer alive, unfortunately, but I've profited over the years from reading his poems. And in a poem that he wrote late in his life, he talked about how there's a thread that you follow. And he was talking about a kind of theme or a set of ideas or questions that become kind of governing realities in a person's life. And as I thought about what Stafford was getting at and applied it to my own scholarly life, I realized that one of the threads that I'd been following or that had been leading me had to do with failure. And in particular, I was realizing that I had spent much of my life studying about ethical failures, that is, the shortfalls and shortcomings that are part of human experience again and again and again, where we know that we fail to do what we ought to do. We fail to do what is right. We fail to do what is good. It doesn't mean that we always act that way, but when it comes to ethical behavior, failure has a pretty big part to play in it. And so I thought, well, maybe what I should do here is follow this thread. And as I did that, what resulted was the book that I call The Failures of Ethics. Now, to get back to your question, one of the things that I have seen when I think about genocide and the Holocaust and other mass atrocity crimes is that these disasters, catastrophes, have been shattering in terms of human hopes and assumptions. And what has happened with these, especially as they accumulate, is that all the sources that we once thought were the kind of foundations for ethics, and I'll get to what I think ethics involves in more detail in a minute, these things have been called into question. It ranges all the way from conscience to reason to religious traditions to all the things that we would normally assume create a kind of moral structure for reality and for history. The fact that so much has happened that has been murderous and destructive and wrong has the effect, I think, of eroding our confidence in the place that that ethical thinking and feeling and reality has in our existence. So genocide is a primary example of ethical failure, because genocide involves the destruction of human groups in the classical definition, as your listeners, many of them will know, the concept of genocide is about the destruction in whole or in part of national, ethnic, religious, or racial groups. And it's so destructive, and it destroys not just life, but it destroys culture, and it can destroy tradition, and it can destroy norms that we thought would help to sustain human flourishing. So ethics has everything to do with genocide, particularly when we're thinking about the failures of ethics, our shortcomings in living up to the ethical standards that we thought and still should believe, I think, are normative for human civilization. I like to think of ethics as the keystone of civilization. And what I mean by that is that at its best, ethics emphasizes careful deliberation about the difference between right and wrong. It also involves encouragement not to be indifferent toward that difference. Ethics also, Ethics is a way of thinking, and it's also a way of acting. But ethics involves cultivation of virtuous character and action that is willing to defend what is right and resist what is wrong. So to give one example here of how ethics would relate to genocide and how the failures of ethics are involved with genocide, one of the fundamental keystone elements of civilization is embodied in the biblical injunction that you shall not murder, shall not murder. But in genocide, murder takes place repeatedly and massively. And so genocide represents, among other things, a massive failure of ethics, a failure of ethics to prevent or to intervene against mass murder.
And John, do you think, you mentioned cultivating cultivating proper ethics or proper responses or ethical successes, I suppose. Do ethical failures compound one another? Do you know what I'm asking? With each failure, does it actually sort of end up, reproducing more failure?
I think there's a tendency to go that way. There's a kind of slippery slope quality to ethical failure. It can start with small things and then bigger things happen. Take lying, for example. It's sometimes been said that if a person lies, then it takes more lies to cover up the lie. And so I think that's one way to think of how a failure of an ethical kind can get compounded, it can get amplified. In genocide, we see this too, because mass killing doesn't just start out of the blue. It requires a developmental path that includes what today we sometimes would call othering, singling out a group of people who are regarded as what? Inferior, as threatening, as an obstacle to some kind of goals that other groups may have. And then propaganda comes into play, amplified by everything from posters to radio to now we have it on the internet that creates an impression of the group that has been identified as threatening and inferior, or however it's understood, and the hostility toward the group gets ramped up and amplified. And if the mentality of some of the people who are ramping up the hostility has genocidal intents in it, which often has happened, then the result is that the othering leads to the conviction and to the policy that group should be eliminated. And the elimination can take place in a variety of ways. It doesn't always have to involve mass killing, but very often that's what happens. So where genocide happens, I think it's always the case that you have an escalation, an amplification of ethical failure that takes place and that eventuates in usually it eventuates in mass killing.
But this can also be a manipulation of ethics, right? You write about the abuse and manipulation when people are other dehumanized, treated, ill treatment. Even murdered and murdered massively in the form of genocide. Do genocide perpetrators and planners sometimes frame this as the ethical thing to do?
Yes, I think this is one of the most challenging and interesting things about what I call the failures of ethics. And it can go like this. There actually are multiple dimensions to it, but I'll track out one of them first. Where genocide takes place, it's usually the case that the people who are committing the genocide are doing this because they at least argue that it's something that must take place. It's something that even is good though it may be very difficult and unpleasant to do it, because the group that is being targeted is regarded as threatening, as inferior, as standing in the way of objectives that ought to be pursued. So people who commit genocide at least put the idea out there in such a way that it looks like they are recommending a policy that is the means to a better end, or that is itself something that is worth doing, is even good. You can see this most clearly, I think, in the Holocaust, where the Nazi ideology that was racially anti-Semitic and targeted the Jews looked on the Jews as almost as an infectious virus that had to be eliminated, and it therefore was a moral duty and obligation. It was a good thing to get rid of the Jewish presence in Nazi Germany, and they developed a whole kind of ethical way of thinking about this. Some scholars have identified what they call the Nazi ethic, or even the Nazi conscience, which sounds like a contradiction on the face of it. But in fact, there was a way in which the Nazis cultivated an ethic and a kind of view about conscience that was genocidal. And it used the ethical categories about, you know, justice and about goodness and about right and wrong. I like to cite a passage from the writings of Dietrich Bonhoeffer that captures this pretty well. Bonhoeffer, of course, was a German Christian theologian who was steadfastly in opposition and resistance to Nazism. And lost his life as a result. But at one point, Bonhoeffer speaks about what he calls the huge masquerade of evil. It's a nice concept, the masquerade of evil that throws, as he puts it, all ethical concepts into confusion by making evil appear in the form of light, good deeds, historical necessity, social justice. I think very often where genocides take place, the perpetrators of the genocide use moral concepts to help incite and justify and warrant the actions that they are taking. Bonhoeffer saw this about Nazi Germany with regard to its policies, specifically with regard to the Jewish people. And it was a masquerade of evil because evil was masquerading in the ethical vocabulary and in the ethical concepts. It perverted the ethical in that way. So that's always a factor that has to be watched when we're thinking about the failures of ethics.
And John, does that connect in some way to how you describe genocide as, quote, no crime is more human or inhuman than genocide?
Yes, I write this line in the book that no crime is more human or inhuman than genocide. Animals that are not human don't commit genocide. Human beings, it takes human beings to create genocide, to have the mentality and the intentionality that targets a group as being so threatening or undesirable that we, the in-group, would be better off without them. So it's genocide is a human enterprise, and it isn't always by any means carried out by by monsters. We ought to avoid that. It's carried out by human beings who are not all that different from you and me, Jeff, but who are hell-bent on destruction of human beings, of other groups. But it's for that reason, then, also inhuman. It's contrary to what we think of when we are thinking at our best about what's valuable, about what's good, about what's right, about what's just. And genocide highlights this because, as I've been emphasizing, genocide targets groups of people. And if you're in the target group, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are as an individual. You could be a brilliant artist. You could be a child. You could be a woman who is pregnant, and it doesn't matter. If you're in the group that's targeted, then from the point of view of the perpetrators, you have to go. You have to be, you know, taken out of the culture and the political reality that the genocide perpetrators believe should exist.
Thank you, John. So can you tell our listeners a bit about the three-term taxonomy? You know, we've talked a bit about perpetrators and victims, but you also talk about bystanders quite a bit in your text. So can you tell us a little bit about this three-term taxonomy, as well as, you know, what you mean when you say they are not separable, static, or purely descriptive?
This, what I call three-term taxonomy of perpetrator, victim, and bystander, has been, well, by now it's become kind of a conventional set of ideas for identifying persons who are in genocidal situations. But it's always been recognized, I think, and now it's been underscored more as we've learned more and studied more, that this three-part categorization has weaknesses. One of them is it looks at first glance as though these are discrete and even separable kinds of categories, like three baskets. You could, you know, put people in these three baskets, and there they would sit. But we know that it's not that simple. First of all, these concepts are not separable from one another. That is, perpetrators always have victims, and victims are, they aren't in play unless there's somebody who's victimizing. And in genocide and mass atrocity crimes, it's always the case that there are people, we sometimes refer to them as bystanders or onlookers, who are neither victims directly, nor are they the killers explicitly, but they are kind of in the mix. And as it turns out, they are actually crucial, because if they stand by and don't get involved and don't take the actions that they could take to prevent or stop something from happening, then the perpetrators have kind of a free hand. And they can go about their business more or less with impunity. So these are insofar as these are helpful concepts, they are all at play in the mix where we have genocide and other mass atrocity crimes. But they aren't static categories. A bystander, for example, can become a perpetrator. And likewise, a bystander might become a victim. And it's fluid and flexible. Even perpetrators might be, they might have a change of heart, though few of them do, and they might end up doing something else. Victims, this is a concept that often seems to remove agency from the people who are targeted by genocide. But we know in all cases, the victims aren't passive. They are doing whatever they can within their power to resist and to elude and to escape from the perpetrators who are trying to destroy them. So these are not static categories. They're fluid and flexible. And what happens with regard to people who might be placed in these categories can change over time. And then the last thing that it occurs to me is important to note here is that these categories of perpetrator, victim, and bystander are, as I say, they're not merely descriptive. They are already laden with ethical content, if you think about it. I mean, being a victim is not a desirable place to be. It's not good to be a victim. It's not good to be a bystander. And it's certainly not good to be a mass murderer, a perpetrator of genocide. So these categories have ethical content kind of built into them. And that leads us to realize that this taxonomy in every instance contains a moral imperative that sort of says you shall not be a perpetrator, you shall not be a victim, and you shall not be a bystander. So that's something that interests me about the very classifications and categorization scheme that we often use in talking about the persons, the players in genocidal situations. Bystander, just to add another word about that category, is probably the least satisfactory among the three as far as giving us a good analytical tool, because there's so many different kinds of bystanding that there can be. Some bystanders are actually enablers. They are not maybe doing the killing, but they may be essential to making it happen. Some people have argued that when you press it hard enough, the bystander category sort of evaporates. That in most cases you move toward people who are enabling something, or who are accomplices, or helping in some way to make it possible for these murderous actions to take place. In a few instances, you have bystanders who move in the direction more of being resistors, rescuers, and people of that sort. So the bystander category is one that we have to think about pretty deeply and be careful about how we are applying it.
And you talked about the ethical content. Does the ethical content and then therefore the ethical response differ depending on the kind of power, influence, or leverage different bystanders have? So say a bystander in Germany to the Holocaust versus a bystander in the United States. And then there's, of course, we could get into even more complicated. States can also be bystanders since they have the ability, the power, the tools to do something, whereas citizens don't. So can you expand a little bit more on that, the content and then the ethical response depending on one's position?
Sure. I think this is very important when we're trying to assess what I call the failures of ethics. It makes a huge difference where someone is located as to what kind of leverage or what kind of influence they can bring to bear on a situation that is genocidal. And it, certainly nations and groups, political groups, religious groups, all kinds of organizations are in this place where we can ask about how are they responding? What kind of leverage do they have? In the Holocaust, for example, there's been, you know, there continues to be lots of discussion about where were the Christian churches with regard to what was happening to the Jews under the swastika. And we're still wrestling with this as the Vatican archives open up in Rome, if people can get to them in the COVID times, to assess the, you know, the problematic reign of Pope Pius XII, who was a person with considerable influence, at least during the Second World War. So there are lots of considerations and subtleties that enter in when we try to assess behavior of people as far as intervention or prevention with regard to genocide may be concerned. But it has to be added that it's very easy for people, individuals, groups, states to rationalize behavior that excuses them from responsibility when they actually do have responsibility, when they are accountable to some extent for what is taking place. So I like to put it this way, that no individual certainly can stop or prevent genocide. But every individual who is located in circumstances akin to mine or to yours, Jeff, can do something to intervene. And when we get to nation states or to groups like religious groups, the same thing applies. It may not be the case that genocide is something easy to prevent or to stop, but we know, as we look over the historical record, that more could always have been done than was actually the case. And this is what kind of reinforces for me again the notion that there is ethical failure that takes place where genocide happens.
Yeah. And
eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, I'm curious, and I'm sure my students in my classes would be curious. Why does it seem so hard to do the ethical thing then? Shouldn't engaging in resistance to genocide be an easy ethical decision? What kind of things interfere with that?
Right. Well, I think most people, with the exception of the people who are committing a genocide, once they know something about what's going on, I think it is a fairly easy call to say what's happening is wrong. I like to put it this way: if genocide isn't wrong, then nothing could be. Now we can get to the point of discussing, and we should do this, about, well, how do we know for sure that a genocide is happening? But let's assume for the moment that we're pretty convinced that genocide is taking place. It's not a very hard call to say that it's wrong, which is interesting because this sort of reinforces the basic factor in ethics, which is that there is a difference between right and wrong, between justice and injustice, between what's good and what isn't. So, but even when we say, no, something is happening and that's genocide and therefore it's wrong, all sorts of things can intrude that forestall ethical action that would resist or protest against or prevent or intervene in a situation. And here we know the problem is it's bigger than with regard to genocide. It's a fundamental human problem. Human beings over and over again are tempted by greed, by power, by advancing their own interests or the interests of their family, trying to enrich themselves. And these human propensities, and here I'll use a word that will have a particular resonance right now, these kinds of factors in human life trump the ethical. The ethical, the understanding of what is right and wrong and just and unjust and good and evil, it has what I think of as a fragile quality about it. It doesn't mean that it's utterly weak, because people can become convinced that something is right or something is wrong, and they can really act on it and they can make big changes with regard to it. But it's also the case that a lot of other human interests can overwhelm or heavier than the strength of the ethical can bear. And this is, as your question points out, this is for me as a philosopher one of the most fascinating and challenging problems, and that is, why isn't the ethical impulse, the ethical conviction, stronger? Why is it so fragile? Why is it so easily overwhelmed and trumped by our, less than noble characteristics? I think this is one of the problems, if I can go here for just a minute, that we're facing here in the United States as Election Day comes up. We have had a paucity of, moral inspiration and leadership in our politics, and that may change as we head into November and the weeks beyond. But we've been living in a case study of how the ethical can be trumped by baser motives and inclinations that are part of our human existence.
And I was thinking of a couple of things. One was just about how state interests also are different than human interests, even though there are humans who are contributing to what we understand to be state interests. But you bringing up the upcoming election, do you think that the way the U.S. has responded to genocide and other atrocities has been a partisan thing, or has there been a general failure?
Yeah, well, you're the expert on this, Jeff, with the work that you've done. So you could correct me when I go ahead and say what I think here if I get it too far wrong. I think that nation states are motivated primarily by what we call national interest. This isn't to their credit, ethically or morally, even though it may be essential for their survival and their independence and their ongoing existence. But national interest, at least, seems very often to create the impression that where genocide is taking place, it isn't in a country's national interest to get involved, to pursue that. Or at least it's not clear that some aspect of a nation's interest would be enhanced and benefited by intervening. Now, there's some pushback that would say, well, wait a second, it's more complicated than that. If we live in a world where we look so much on our own national interests that we just stand by while all sorts of human rights abuses are taking place and mass murder is occurring and genocide is happening, then that maybe isn't in our national interest because it allows, it's allowing those kinds of destructive powers to have their way. That could be one part. And another part of it might be, and I think this comes home to roost with the United States, that allowing these kinds of actions to take place, these violations of human rights and human dignity, is so contrary to the values that we profess to have as a country, as a culture, that we had better be involved or else we're just hypocrites of the worst sort. As we pound our chests about how important, you know, human rights are in the United States, but if we don't act to defend human rights in other parts of the world, then even if we're defending that point of view from some kind of account of national interest, we still, you know, I think are in a situation where we can say some ethical failure has taken place. Because national interest simply cannot be equated with what is right and good and just. It all depends on what the national interest is leading people to do and leading the country to defend and to serve. That's how you judge whether the national interest is ethical or moral, not just because it exists.
Right. And what is good or what is in the national interest doesn't always have to be material, right? It could be moral good as well, and doing what's right. Yes. In different situations. Now, you mentioned you know, hypocrisy of the worst kind or the potential for that. That leads to, in some ways, to another question I had for you, which is you know, whether individualistic societies actually produce individually minded individuals. You know, does individualism work counter to a quote-unquote good Samaritan ethic?
I think this is an important question because it's it ends up being a complicated question. I think a kind of individualism can lead to a selfishness that looks out only for oneself and one's own interests. This could be true of an individualistic understanding of the nation state, I think, as well. You know, the current administration's emphasis on America first bears watching in this regard, because if that means America to the exclusion of, you know, other nation states and what the cooperation between those states ought to be, then that's a difficulty. So individualistic societies may produce individuals and may become societies that are self-centered in a way that is dangerous and can even be destructive. But it's also true on the other side that the ethical imperatives that we, you know, regard as most fundamental for civilization always have a point of contact with individuals, or they don't have much power. So, for example, if we go back to the the fundamental injunction against murder. That applies to me as a person. I'm not a person who should murder. It's wrong if I do that. And by extension, then it becomes the case that my society, the groups I belong to, the nation state that I'm a citizen of, also is held to account by this standard if they become murderous. So the place of the individual or the concept of individualism in this mix is a complex one. It can lead to indifference, to inaction, to selfishness, but it also is a case that unless the individual feels the bite of a moral injunction or moral imperative, those norms and the traditions that support them are going to be weakened.
Right. And, you know, I wanted to take a step back because I didn't want to just gloss over, you know, what you had said about, you know, my own work on the United States and its relationship with genocide. So sorry to make this an abrupt transition here, but, you know, I wanted to just raise this with you. You know, the cases that I looked at, you know, and I found that the United States played some role, whether it's failing to prevent based on the Bosnia versus Serbia ICJ standard, or something more. Oftentimes, the cases did involve a Republican administration, and I wonder, you know, since we've got into a little bit about the upcoming election, do you think there's a different ethic or a different ethical approach to how we respond to or our relationships with governments that have committed genocide, depending on one administration or another?
I think there can be. I'd have to go back and review some of the history that you've explored so much to feel very confident about this.
Sorry for putting you on the spot.
if you take the current predicament that we are in here, I am guessing that an Obama administration, a Biden administration, might be more inclined to participate in genocide prevention than Donald Trump's administration has been or would be. So, you know, in the immediate term, yeah, there might be some difference between the political perspectives that the parties have. I think we've all followed with some dismay, I think, some of the polling that's been done that suggests that the United States' esteem in the world presently is lower than it once was, and maybe dangerously low. And that has something to do with the decline of attention to alliances and to international cooperation and to working together with other nation states to advance common interests and common ground. But I think in general, the United States gets not much better than a B minus when it comes to genocide intervention and prevention. There have been cases where there's been great reluctance to even acknowledge that genocide is taking place. And the reasons for that have to do, at least in part, with the notion that if a signatory to the United Nations Genocide Convention acknowledges that a genocide is taking place, then there's some obligation to do something about that. So the reluctance sometimes to use what euphemistically has been called the G word, use the genocide word to identify an action that's underway, you know, the United States has not been immune to that temptation. And it goes back to one other point, which is a general concern where we're talking about genocide. And that has to do with how do we know when a genocide is actually happening or taking place? The concept of genocide itself has been argued about. It's been interpreted in various ways. And so that's an issue. But it's also true that one of the problems that haunts the crime of genocide is that for it to be identified as a crime, there has to be some reliable conviction that an intention is at work to destroy a group in whole or in part. And in any kind of legal situation where the burden of proof rests to some extent on intention, on identifying an intent, that's difficult and complicated.
It creates a high bar. With the Genocide Convention explicitly talking about the contracting parties have a responsibility to prevent and punish, if you have to first establish that the intent is there, even when it's challenging to establish intent, even after the fact, when you have time to, you know, try and find documents and review all of the evidence, it makes it very difficult to invoke the Genocide Convention before irreparable harm has been done, because, you know, the irreparable harm, the many people have been killed, is evidence or potential evidence of genocide.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The evidence of the intent is actually the murder that's taking place. But as you point out, that's already far later than a robust moral response to genocide would encourage. We don't want to have, you know, 800,000 dead Tutsis before we state that a genocide took place in Rwanda. So that's a difficulty. And I don't know the way around it. I am interested in a doctrine that is under discussion. It hasn't been getting all the attention it deserves, but I think it's an idea that is worth keeping in focus, and that's the idea of the responsibility to protect, which has garnered some international support, at least, you know, earlier in this century. Things are all tossed up in the air now because of COVID and the pandemic, those times that we're in, and all the rest of it. But the idea of that nations have a responsibility to protect societies that either cannot protect their citizens or are unwilling to protect their citizens has content in it that I think we would forget or overlook at our peril.
Right. And I don't want to get too far down a new rabbit hole, but do you have any thoughts on the intervention in Libya and how that may have stunted R2P's normative progress?
Yeah, the problem with the responsibility to protect is if its strength is that it advocates intervention, then the question always becomes, okay, if intervention takes place, then is that fitting what the ideal of the responsibility to protect is defending? Or have we simply got another case of a nation interfering in the life of another in a way that is problematic? And that's a tension that the ideal of the responsibility to protect has to keep wrestling with, I think.
I agree, especially when, it's unfortunate that you know, the intervention in Libya has either been, you know, used rightly or wrongly, I'd say wrongly, but to impact the response to what's happening in Syria, or what has been happening in Syria. Well, we're almost out of time. So I wanted to end with, you know, something that you talk about in the conclusion of your book. And in it, you write, quote, "It matters whether the right side of history exists, but arguably something else matters more, at least for us who live and die in the fleeting moments and short-lived places of the time that is ours. What we choose to do matters more. How we confront the failures of ethics, protesting and resisting them so that human life can flourish, matters more. The best salvage crews do not rely on the right side of history. They are not motivated, at least not primarily, by belief in it, nor are they disheartened or deterred by doubt that the right side of history exists. Awareness that disaster is a fact, that catastrophe has happened, is enough to keep them on the move. Never letting go of that thread can bring joy that makes all the difference in the world." In closing from that, we are able to, are we able to end on an optimistic note? Have we made progress in preventing, responding, and resisting genocide? Has the failures of ethics had its reckoning?
I end the book, as you point out, with a reflection on a concept that we're hearing quite a lot about recently in our politics, and that's the idea of the right side of history. The notion that there is a moral structure to things, to history in particular, and that some actions and policies are on the right side and others are on the wrong side, and that somehow things are moving in a direction that favors the right side. I think the classic text in American life that reflects this is Martin Luther King Jr.'s statement that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. That would be one of the articulations of belief in the right side of history. My position on this is that, as some others have pointed out, the concept of the right side of history has been used, and perhaps we could say abused, in all sorts of ways. I think Hitler would have said that his policies were on the right side of history. We would say, well, in terms of Dr. King's idea, well, the arc is long, and what we learned is that Hitler's thinking is on the wrong side of history. So it's important, as I say, whether the right side of history exists or not. But it seems to me that most of the time, when we're thinking about what leads people to take an action to defend what is right and what is just, and to oppose what is unjust and what is wrong, I think it's the realities of those things as we experience them on the ground in the times and places where we live that is the motivation or the failure of a motivation to act. And the idea of the right side of history may be, you know, in the background somewhere, but I don't think it's the primary driver that leads to the moral action that would be required, for example, if we were to successfully prevent or intervene against a genocide. I think it's the reality on the ground, the seeing of the suffering, seeing of the murder, witnessing the dead, the accumulation of the dead, that leads us to say, enough is enough, we've got to do something, we have to act. Or if we're enablers and complicit with the activity, it's the things that are happening on the ground that lead us also to, you know, act that way. So that's why I end the book, as you say, that awareness that disaster is a fact, that catastrophe has happened, is enough to keep people on the move if they are going to be acting in a way that resists moral failure. And then I just want to underscore one other thing, because you asked me in the preparation for our time together whether there was a way to end this conversation on a bit of an optimistic note. And I think there is, because the last line in my book is that awareness that disaster is a fact, that catastrophe has happened, is enough to keep people on the move. Never letting go of that thread can bring joy that makes all the difference in the world. I believe that there's such a thing as what I call an in spite of joy. It's a joy in spite of the atrocity, in spite of the mass killing, in spite of the mass murder, that says I and the groups that I'm part of will resist. We will protest. We will do what we can to prevent and to forestall mass atrocities and to try to heal and save lives. And in that action, strange as it may sound, I think joy can be found. It's not a sentimental kind of joy or a feel-good kind of joy that's related to pleasure. It's a joy that is related deeply to meaning, to doing something that is deeply and profoundly meaningful. And I link it in some ways to a favorite statement of mine that comes from W.E.B. Du Bois, the great Black interpreter of racism early in the 20th century. Du Bois says at one point that he clings to a hope, not hopeless, but unhopeful. So I think that's an attitude that has merit. It's especially meaningful coming from the context and circumstances that Du Bois and his people experienced in America and are still experiencing. But there's something here that I like, because he recognizes that there still is hope. It isn't hopeless, but it isn't optimistic necessarily. It isn't assuming too much about what will happen that favors what is right and good. But I think in the striving for that, in the striving to resist and protest and to intervene and to prevent mass atrocity crimes, there can be a kind of joy that is deeply meaningful, and a hope that is not hopeless, even if it is to some extent unhopeful.
Thank you, John. And I'll just say before we wrap up here is I actually sent my students a note today because I've been teaching a graduate human rights course. And, you know, I don't want to contribute to hopelessness, but I think it's also important that, you know, that the students recognize that there are impediments to affecting change. And then you have to develop strategies and approaches and, you know, and hope to make that change despite those roadblocks.
Yes. Right. And there you have the in spite of thing coming in and what you said.
And that wasn't even planned.
I do think as people work together, as they find solidarity with one another, especially in trying to alleviate suffering and save lives and help to heal those who are victimized, that there's meaning to be found in doing that includes the sense of joy that I have in mind.
Well, thank you, John. Your sense of joy is somewhat contagious. I'm smiling. It's been an honor to speak with you, and I really enjoyed our conversation. Before I do let
enjoyed it too, Jeff. Thanks. Yeah,
thank you. Is there anything you want to plug for our listeners? Anything you're currently working on?
The latest book that I've done might be of some interest to your listeners. It's a volume that Carol Rittner and I have compiled that is called Advancing Holocaust Studies. And it has implications for genocide studies, too. But the dilemma that we are wrestling with in that book, and we have a variety of contributors to it, is to think about what it means to be engaged in study of the Holocaust, or we could say study of other genocides too, particularly in the times that we're living in 2020, when we have a pandemic going on, when we're living in a society where racism has had an upsurge, anti-Semitism has not been blunted, democracies around the world are imperiled. And so we were kind of trying to get people to reflect on this in a personal and professional way about what Holocaust studies, we could extrapolate and say what genocide studies are for. What are they for in times like the ones that we're living in? And, you know, as we speak, there are genocidal initiatives that are taking place in our world right now. One thinks about the Rohingya people, and there's concern about the Armenians again, as they are caught in situations in their region of the world. So trying to think about what it is that we're doing, what we're assuming, what we're defending, that's the project in the book called Advancing Holocaust Studies.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing, John. This all sounds so important. And thanks again. If there's an opportunity to do this again, I would love to do it.
Absolutely. Me too.
All right. Well, take care, John.
Take care, Jeff.